This program is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor.
I went to a number of WASP boarding schools, particularly one called Harvey and the other called Hotchkiss. When they showed the first pictures of the Holocaust at Hotchkiss, the entire school cheered, and the boys said to me, "Well, Johnny, well, we don't like Hitler, but at least he's killed the Jews."
I recall once driving through Pennsylvania, and there was a bed and breakfast with a sign outside that said, "No dogs or Jews allowed." I'd never seen anything like that.
This is No Dogs or Jews Allowed, the story of anti-Semitism in America. Part of the series, Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson. We heard from Ambassador John Loeb, Jr. and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Here's Rita Kaplan.
The first time I experienced it was when I went to college into Wisconsin, and there was a gal from Peshtigo, Wisconsin. And one night, it's dark in the room, and she's feeling, and I said, "What's the matter? Are you looking for an aspirin?" And she blurted out, "I wanted to see if you had horns." I said, "Horns?" And she told me all about the fact that in this little town, they all believed that the Jews had horns.
America has been one of the most hospitable and safest places for Jews in their long history. However, American Jewish history has been punctuated by a number of ugly incidents of anti-Semitism. Some overt, others hidden beneath the surface. Public displays of anti-Semitism peaked between the two world wars.
It should be the duty of every citizen to demand of the sponsors of the large programs to stop feeding the public the trash of the Winchells, the Cantors, the Burns and Bernsteins, and give the American public for a change a voice which really speaks the American language without a Jewish accent.
That from a 1939 rally held by the pro-Nazi German-American Bund. A cheering crowd of 19,000 filled Madison Square Garden, which was adorned with Nazi-like flags and 400 guards dressed like stormtroopers.
Some people say hatred of the Jews is as old as our people.
Elie Wiesel.
But in truth, you know, it's irrational.
The Jews have a certain aura.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton.
It's a mixture of some sort of magical, omnipotent power on the one hand and some kind of evil or destructiveness on the other. Any group that is victimized is assumed to have some such combination.
Anti-Semitism is based on Christian teachings. My position is, in the Western world, no Christianity, no anti-Semitism.
Leonard Dinnerstein is professor emeritus of history at the University of Arizona. He explains that early Christians accused Jews of killing Christ. The charge of deicide persisted in Catholic liturgy into the 1960s.
We have the plagues, and the plagues are allegedly caused by the Jews who have poisoned the wells. In the Middle Ages, Christians were not allowed to lend other Christians money and collect interest. That provided an opening for the Jews. They became what was known then as usurers. They lent money and they collected interest. From this activity, we get the prejudice towards bloodsuckers, money grubbers, Jews being only concerned with money.
This negative image of the Jew has been used in literature for centuries.
Well, Shylock, shall we be beholding to you?
The best known is Shylock, from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. His name has entered the language as a slang word for usurer.
You call me misbeliever, cutthroat dog, and spit upon my Jewish gabardine, and all for use of that which is mine own. Well then, it now appears you need my help. Go to then. You come to me, and you say, Shylock, we would have monies.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton is professor emeritus of psychiatry and psychology at the City University of New York.
The designated victim throughout much of European history was the Jew. If one can speak of a designated victim in the United States, it would be blacks.
What has happened over the course of American history is that anti-Semitic stereotypes have been imported from Europe to the United States.
Jack Wertheimer is professor of American Jewish history at the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Given the imported nature of so many anti-Semitic ideas, why is it that the end result was never the same as it was in European societies?
In the early days, Jews encountered the same anti-Semitic stereotypes in the New World that they had in Europe, but it didn't play out in quite the same way. The first group of Jews arrived in North America in September 1654. They were Dutch Jews who left Recife, Brazil, after the Portuguese retook the colony from the Dutch. They carried dark memories of the Portuguese Inquisition, which had forced their ancestors to convert or die by fire. 23 landed in New Amsterdam. Governor Peter Stuyvesant didn't want them.
Peter Stuyvesant was an ardent member of the Dutch Reformed Church.
Dr. Jack Wertheimer.
And his views of the Jews were heavily colored by medieval anti-Semitic stereotypes. When he wrote to the Dutch West India Company, Peter Stuyvesant explained that he did not want to include these Jews in the colony of New Amsterdam.
September 22, 1654, to the directors of the Dutch West India Company. The Jews who have arrived would nearly all like to remain here, but learning that they, with their customary usury and deceitful trading with the Christians, were very repugnant to the inferior magistrates, we have deemed it useful to require them in a friendly way to depart, praying also most seriously in this connection that this deceitful race, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, be not allowed to further infect and trouble this new colony to the detraction of your worships and the dissatisfaction of your worships' most affectionate subjects.
Now, in truth, the Jews who arrived were not in any position to engage in money-lending activities, but nonetheless he projected onto them that they were money-lenders. By comparison with the way in which Christians of the wrong denominations were treated, Jews were actually treated far better. Catholics, for example, were given a much more difficult time, and Quakers he hanged.
The Dutch West India Company denied Stuyvesant's request to deport the 23 Jews. One reason? There were Jewish investors in the company. As a tiny group in colonial America, Jews were below the radar.
The United States always was a heterogeneous environment, and that provided and continues to provide cover for Jews in this country.
During the drafting of the Constitution, there was no debate about Jewish rights in particular. This was significant. European countries often debated the so-called Jewish question, passing restrictive laws specifically directed at Jews. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants from all over Europe came to the United States in the mid-1800s. Among them were 200,000 Jews from the German states and other parts of Western Europe. They began as peddlers, who later became shopkeepers. Some of those shops eventually became Sears, Gimbel's, Bloomingdale's, and Macy's.
In trying to understand how Jews were able to succeed, and this really is a story of success.
Hasia Diner is professor of American Jewish history at NYU.
it's very important to not tell it in a kind of flat way that it was because of their hard work they succeeded, although they surely worked very hard. But the context was a perfect one for them in that they had one of the essential characteristics which Americans valued, which is they were white.
Jews did encounter social discrimination, but that's very different from more public, let alone organized, efforts at anti-Semitism. That story begins to take off with what happened during the Civil War.
During the Civil War, the North needed Southern cotton for its textile mills. Northern traders were forbidden to trade with the enemy. This created a huge black market for cotton. General Grant had the power to issue trading licenses.
Word reached Grant that there were Jews who were doing all the speculating.
Eli Evans is an author and a scholar of Southern Jewish history.
Now, soldiers were feeding him stories about this because if they could get rid of the Jews, they would have the cotton at the same rate that everybody else did. And Grant bought it and issued a very harsh judgment that all Jews would have to be expelled in 48 hours.
General Orders No. 11, Headquarters 13th Army Corps, Department of the Tennessee, December 17, 1862. The Jews, as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. By order of Major General Ulysses S. Grant, John A. Rawlins, Assistant Adjutant General.
This was a shocking thing. Think about this for a minute. There were 7,000 Jews in the military. All kinds of figures won accolades for this war. And a movement began to get underway to go and visit Lincoln. Lincoln wrote a note to the general in chief of the army, Henry Halleck, directing him to telegraph instructions to cancel the order. This was one of the deepest sensations of the war. This man canceled the general order of his leading general. This story followed Grant all the way into the presidential election of 1868. And Grant finally said, "I have no prejudice," he said, "against sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit. Order No. 11 does not sustain this statement, I admit, but I do not sustain the order. I would never have issued it had it not been telegraphed the moment it was penned and without reflection." So goes General Grant, and so goes the next president of the United States.
Grant's Order No. 11 was the worst eruption of anti-Semitism in the United States up to that point. Widespread anti-Semitism began to emerge a few years later, near the end of the 19th century.
After the ball is over, after the break of war.
Here's Jack Wertheimer.
Most historians focus far more on the Gilded Age. When we talk about a more public expression of anti-Semitism, it's in the press. Anti-Semitism is expressed in the vaudeville routines, and one can document anti-Semitic expressions far more readily.
Joseph Seligman was a wealthy Jewish banker from New York City. In 1877, he tried to check into the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga Springs. Deborah Dashmoor is professor of history at the University of Michigan. She explains that Seligman had been vacationing in Saratoga for years, yet he was now denied a room at the hotel.
It's made clear to him that he's being denied because he is a Jew and that this is a new policy to make the Christian guests at the hotel more comfortable. The response is one of outrage in the newspapers. It leads Jews to say, okay, we'll build our own hotels where we will be welcome. This rise of social anti-Semitism appears in other areas of social life as well. Clubs, Jews were founders of the Union League Club, for example, and by the end of the 19th century, they're no longer accepted as members.
There is something the matter with Jews. Most of the American nouveau riche don't even know what's the matter with Jews, so they have to make up all kinds of stories. Jews are loud. Jews have no manners. Jews are simply not Christians.
As the 19th century turned into the 20th, Americans began to move from farms to the cities.
I saw the weary farmer plowing sod and loam, and I've heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home.
This profoundly changed American society as farmers became factory workers. Dr. Robert J. Lifton.
Every society has undergone enormous anxiety in relation to that transition from the agrarian to the industrial, and the Jews are a convenient scapegoat for the cause of the dislocation and anxiety and pain.
Two economic panics added to the general unease of the late 19th century. Populists blamed Jews for all that was wrong in America.
Might it not be that the money lenders of London, the magnificent titled Shylocks of our modern world, who play with czars, emperors, and kings as a chess player with castles, rooks, and pawns in the artificial production of a panic, may have purposely wrought the ruin of many American banks? Illustrated America, July 27, 1895.
The most glaring example of the explosion of this populist anti-Semitism was the Leo Frank affair.
Leo Frank was the manager of a pencil factory in Atlanta. On April 26, 1913, Mary Fagan, a 13-year-old girl, was found raped and murdered in the factory.
Little Mary Fagan, she went to town one day. She went to the pencil factory.
Frank, who was Jewish, was arrested, tried, and convicted of the murder.
Leo Frank met her with a brutally hot Reno. He smiled and said, "Little Mary, now you go home no more."
He was convicted largely on the word of the factory's janitor, a black man named Jim Connolly.
Leo Frank was most likely innocent. My instinct is that Leo Frank might have been guilty of what today would be called sexual harassment. It doesn't make him a murderer, though.
Steve Oney wrote an exhaustive history of the Leo Frank affair. He says that the jury convicted Leo Frank for many reasons. Anti-Semitism was only one. They also resented him as an educated, upper-class northerner.
It was, in some ways, a perfect storm of class, religion, and sexual charges.
Just before he was to be hanged, the governor of Georgia commuted his sentence to life in prison.
From that moment forth, the plotting to lynch Leo Frank began.
During the summer of 1915, a group of upstanding citizens from Marietta, the hometown of the murdered girl, made careful plans to take the law into their own hands. They were egged on by the influential populist Tom Watson, who published racist and often anti-Semitic rants in his newspaper, The Jeffersonian.
Our grand old Empire State has been raped. We have been violated, and we are ashamed. Mary Fagan, pursued and tempted, and entrapped and then killed. There she lies at Marietta, unavenged by the law. In the name of God, what are the people to do? Hereafter, let no man reproach the South with lynch law. Let him remember the unendurable provocation, and let him say whether lynch law is not better than no law at all.
The lynch party walked into the prison unopposed, abducted Leo Frank, and lynched him in Marietta. No one was ever charged with a crime.
The Leo Frank case was a kind of incredible shock for the immigrant generation.
Eli Evans.
Here was a man who was at the top of society socially. If this could happen to him, it could happen to anyone. They did not feel Frank was guilty. To them, this was a deeply anti-Semitic event.
Jack Wertheimer puts the Leo Frank story in perspective.
Let's recall that Leo Frank was one Jew who was lynched. This in a southern environment in which it was quite common for black people to be lynched in the hundreds. The General Order Number 11 of Ulysses Grant during the Civil War, in some senses, was potentially a far greater threat to American Jews because of the fact that it was issued by a government official. It's one thing if it bubbles up from a lynch mob, but it becomes far more serious when the governor of a territory issues such a decree.
From 1880 to 1920, over 2 million Jews came to the United States from Russia and Eastern Europe. They became a substantial minority. Millions more, Italians, Poles, and Irish, arrived at about the same time.
So this then raised in the minds of quite a number of Americans the fear that the quality of American life would be affected by the arrival of these new immigrants. The argument of racist anti-Semites in the early 20th century was these new immigrants will dilute the nature of American society.
Many of the most respected leaders of the time, including politicians and scientists, subscribed to the eugenics theory. Advocates of the pseudoscience of eugenics thought they could improve the human race like cows or corn. They supported policies to keep certain undesirable elements out of the country's gene pool, like Jews, who were thought to be an inferior race. Newly arrived immigrants to Ellis Island were given intelligence tests. A 1913 study stated that 83% of Jews tested were feeble-minded. The Nazis imported American eugenics to bolster their racial theories.
The most threatening era in the history of American anti-Semitism was the era between the two world wars. World War I brought terrible, terrible loss of life and terrible upheaval. And after that came the Bolshevik Revolution. There was a great fear within American society about a world that America had been able to keep at a further distance.
The fear was that immigrants were importing communist or anarchist ideas. Fueled by this fear, Congress passed a series of laws that restricted immigration. The 1924 Immigration Act barred Asian immigration completely and set quotas for Europeans. Jewish and Catholic immigration was reduced to a trickle.
Those bills in the 1920s came just one decade before the Nazi era, when Jews would desperately need a haven of refuge, and now the United States was virtually closed to Jewish immigration.
Dr. Jack Wertheimer.
The intensity of anti-Semitism in the United States has to be understood against the backdrop also of the importation of viciously anti-Semitic ideologies common in books that were written at the time.
The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion was written in 1903, a crude forgery by the Tsarist secret police. It includes many of the most scurrilous myths about Jews. The protocols were written as the supposed minutes of a meeting of the 12 tribes of Israel planning the takeover of the world.
It is indispensable to trouble in all countries the people's relations with their governments so as to utterly exhaust humanity with dissension, hatred, struggle, envy, and even by the use of torture, by starvation, by the inoculation of diseases, by want, so that the Goyim see no other issue than to take refuge in our complete sovereignty in money and in all else. The Goyim are a flock of sheep, and we are their wolves. And you know what happens when the wolves get hold of the flock.
From the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, an entirely invented account of a Jewish plot to dominate the world. It has been accepted as truth by anti-Semites all over the world. The book has been widely distributed for over 100 years and is still a bestseller. Henry Ford swallowed the protocols whole. In the 1920s, he printed a series based on them in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent. Under the banner The International Jew, Ford accused Jews of everything from world financial domination to fixing baseball games. The articles were immensely popular and ran for almost 2 years. Hitler was inspired by them when he wrote his manifesto, Mein Kampf, a blueprint for all that was to come.
The Dearborn Independent, September 11, 1920. Does Jewish Power Control the World Press? The Jewish journalist who panders to unrest, whose literary ambition is to maintain a ferment in his readers, as well as the Jewish novelist, must be listed as the agents of that world program which would break down society through the agency of ideas. And it is very striking how many there are, and how skillfully they conceal their propaganda in their work.
Professor Leonard Dinnerstein.
In 1927, Louis Marshall, for the American Jewish Committee, gets Henry Ford to say he's not anti-Semitic and he's not going to publish anything from the Protocols of the Zion.
Ford's letter of apology was almost certainly drafted by Louis Marshall. Ford probably signed it as part of the settlement of a libel suit brought against him. He was also trying to stop a Jewish boycott of his cars.
I was sad and I was blue, but now I'm just as good as you since Henry Ford apologized to me. That's why you threw away your little Chevrolet and bought yourself a Ford coupe.
Skeptics doubt that Ford's letter was sincere. In 1938, he accepted the High Cross of the German Eagle, the highest honor Nazi Germany could give to a foreigner.
The mama said she'd feed him if he called. Gewilte fish and matzo ball.
Yeah, yeah, as a muzzle of deer.
I put the family jewels in hock and bought myself a share of stock since Henry Ford apologized to me.
Anti-Semitism began to affect the climate in which Jews were living.
Jack Wertheimer.
Not only the wealthiest Jews who were barred from entering certain country clubs, but also the immigrant Jews who were faced with employment ads that explicitly stated white Protestants only need to apply. And later on, that carried into housing discrimination.
New York Times, July 31st, 1927. Help wanted. Secretary Stenographer, Christian Firm, desires a young lady of refinement to assist in office. Christian Firm has opening for beginner. Chicago Tribune, March 15, 1925. Wanted, female help. Protestant, 25 to 35. A large South Side concern has a specific opening for an Underwood machine operator. Must be Gentile.
When the quotas came into effect at institutions of higher learning, they were people who wanted to become doctors or lawyers or engineers who simply could not pursue those careers because of those quotas.
Richard Feynman was an exceptionally bright math and science student in high school. In 1935, he applied to Columbia University.
Although he had won math contests so that he was known to be the best mathematician in 5 states in high school, he was not accepted.
Joan Feynman, Richard Feynman's sister.
Now, my father thought this was rather odd and went to Columbia to ask why. As I understand it, they hemmed and hawed until he said, well, is it because he was Jewish? And they said yes.
Feynman was accepted by MIT. 4 years later, he applied to Princeton for grad school. Feynman was admitted, but not before MIT answered a question posed by Princeton. Is Feynman Jewish? MIT answered, Feynman is of course Jewish, but compared with Kanner or Eisenbud, he is more attractive personally by several orders of magnitude. Richard Feynman shared the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1965. Jews dealt with hiring and housing discrimination by creating their own businesses and country clubs, and by living in predominantly Jewish neighborhoods. They constructed a parallel world that still exists to some extent today. You're listening to No Dogs or Jews Allowed, the story of anti-Semitism in America. I'm Larry Josephson. We'll be back in a minute.